Hey, yo, and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music is on the air and in your ear. Once again, I'm Mo, and once again, I got the man with the golden voice with me. He's the king of the casters, Mr. Brett Podcast. Brett, this is another one that we've been really looking forward to. Tell us about today's guest.
Oh, absolutely. Well, today's guest, one of our favorite drummers, really of the era, like of all time, for sure. I mean, he's played on some incredible albums with Wasp, with Keel, with LA Guns, and of course LA Guns is the reason that we are here to talk to him. He is Steve Riley. Steve, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's good to be here.
So obviously, I mean, the reason that we're here, of course, you got the new album coming out from LA Guns, which we haven't heard yet, but we have heard Crawl. It's a great single, and I mean, honestly, it's like Mo and I talked to Kelly last week, and I mean, awesome guy. And I think one thing that I know is that the new single sounds so much like classic LA Guns.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, with Kelly and I, we really didn't want to drift away from what we really are and what we write and sound like. And it was a conscientious effort to make it as close to what we really are. And we hope that we conveyed that too with Crawl, and we got such a wide depth of material on the album too, and we can't wait for everybody to hear it. But we're really glad so far with the response to Crawl. A lot of people really dig it.
And then when you're putting together an album and you're doing the writing, like how quickly did the songs come together for this album?
Well, I tell you what, you know, this was a definite different experience because Kelly's living in New York. Kurt is the singer is in Florida. Scotty Griffin's in Las Vegas and I'm in Los Angeles. So, you know, this was a different thing that I had ever done. I believe of the other guys too, where we did a lot of stuff through the internet where we were all sitting on material that we had written. And some of it was written right before we recorded, but a lot of it was stuff that we had written on our own, and we started exchanging ideas through the internet and sending each other songs. And we had a lot of material. We ended up with 10 songs on the album, but we had really 25 to 30 songs that we were exchanging back and forth. And I had never done anything like it before. You know, usually everybody's living in the same town, and we just get together at a rehearsal studio, and we start doing a pre-production together, and we come in the next day, and we continue on doing a pre-production and working on the material. This was different. We used about two and a half months of exchanging ideas and songs that we had already written on our own, and it was a really wild kind of organic experience. And so, you know, once we finished that, doing that, I booked the schedule that we had was old school, where the guys came into town, into Los Angeles, and we went into a pre-production studio, a rehearsal studio, and we worked for 2 days on everything that we had been working on through the internet. And we went 24 hours. We went from morning to evening on pre-production together and pieced everything together that we had wanted to do with the 10 songs. We had already known, we knew the 10 songs that we wanted to do. So once we got into that pre-production studio, we just went at it. And I was really proud of the guys. We really, really did a great job of utilizing the time that we had in those 48 hours. And then the third day was us right into the recording studio. So we did 2 days of pre-production in a rehearsal studio and then 7 days of recording in a recording studio right in a row. And it was 9 days of just banging out old style and recording old style and just going right at it. Not too much thought process where we were overthinking it and wondering, should we do this? We kind of had a great idea of what we wanted to do. And it was like a true old style thing because I'm a fan of bands like everybody else, Zeppelin and Sabbath and bands like that. When they did their albums, they didn't think them out too much. They went in and just recorded them, and it was a very organic process, and we really utilized every bit of time that we had, and we did those 9 days together, and then I sent the guys back home, and myself and the engineer, we mixed them for 4 days and then mastered it, and it was done, and was just really happy with the way it came out, but it was definitely a different experience.
Now, I mean, I know it's really early to start thinking about the next album, but, like, do you think this kind of process is the same kind of thing that you would use going forward? Do you, like, especially when it comes to the songwriting, do you think you'd rather, like, kind of go to more of an original thing where everybody's in a room trying to hash things out?
I think so. I think that, you know, maybe just at least about 2 or 3 more days of a pre-production, just so we had a little bit of an easy schedule, and we really had to jam a little bit, you know, with knowing that we had this tight budget, tight schedule, everybody flying in, staying at hotels, and it was, I hope that we can get at least 2 or 3 more days of pre-production together, and maybe like a couple more days of recording and mixing, because you always look back on it and you say, wow, I could have made a different move on that song, because I produced the album, and I look back on it and I'm really happy with the way it's turned out. But like everybody else, you say, wow, I might have been able to make a different move on that song and maybe bring up this or bring down that. But again, that works in your favor that you didn't overthink it. But yeah, a couple more days of pre-production, a couple more days of recording and mixing would be nice, where we could spend maybe 2 full weeks on it instead of 9 days. Just a few more days would work out. But because everybody lives in different areas of the country, I see almost the same situation happening. And all 4 of the guys in the band, we write a lot on our own, and we've demoed a lot on our own, and have been sitting on material for quite a while. So I see a lot of it being the same way, where we're utilizing the web and where the internet, and we're exchanging ideas before we do fly everybody out. So when everybody gets here, we do have a great idea of what we're having. We don't have that luxury of the old days when we could block out a month or maybe even 2 months in a rehearsal studio to work on songs right from the very beginning. And so, you know, I see it being pretty much similar because of everybody living in different locales now.
How awesome was it, I guess, to get Kelly back, you know, really back on stage and back playing with the band?
Oh, man, it was awesome because, you know, he's my partner. He's my battery mate, too. And we were the rhythm section on all of those L.A. Guns albums, the early L.A. Guns albums. And we just formed a nice relationship as a drummer and bass player. And not only recording, but live, too. And we were very, very close. We were really tight friends, too. Never, ever had a problem with each other. And getting him back in the band was awesome. I got to tell you that, because not only getting a friend back and a former original member back with me, but it was also getting my battery mate back with me too. And we have such a great fusion working together. And I just got to say, all the way around, it's been an awesome experience playing and having Kelly back in the band. And not only that, I think everybody knows that Kelly wrote Ballad of Jane, our biggest hit, and he's just a prolific songwriter. He's the one that came in with the gist of the song Crawl, and we worked on it, and we all have credit on it, and we do that. We share credit on all the songs, because somebody will come in with pretty much the gist of the idea, and that's what he did with Crawl. So Kelly's a really great songwriter, too, and he not only wrote Ballad of Jane, but he wrote a lot of the early material, too. And when I say wrote it, because we all took credit on all of the material in the early days, too, it's pretty much somebody coming in with that gist of an idea on a song, and then all of us working on it to finish it. But I got to tell you, Kelly being back with me and us being a rhythm section again is just really awesome. We're really digging it.
How about your own songwriting contributions? What are some of the ones that you can highlight that, you know, you can tell people about that that they may know?
Are you talking from this album, Renegades, or something from the past?
Both.
You know what? It's, again, my specialty is, even though on this Renegades album, I brought in two of the songs that I had written previously on my own, and they made the album. But I, in the early days, a lot of my stuff was helping to finish songs. It was helping to put a beginning and an ending on a song, putting a bridge into a song, and making a whole song, you know. And Blackie Lawless and Wasp was really good songwriter, and you know, I learned a lot working with him too. And so my specialty in the early days was to help finish that song off and put it together and make sure that it was a complete song and we can get in and out of the song. There was a bridge. There was it was a good separation within the song. So that's really what I kind of like specialize in that, and just helping finish songs up and make them whole. And that's what I did in the early days. And this Renegades album, I actually brought in two songs that I had been sitting on that I had written a while ago, and I never got to record them with LA Guns, and these guys heard them, and we've, again, they came in like I did, and they finished them up and helped tailor them so they were complete songs. But I kind of pride myself into being somebody that can help shape the song and the gist of the idea. And so, you know, that's pretty much where I stand with songwriting. But on Renegades, I actually brought in two complete original ideas that the guys love.
One of the things that I'm really interested in, and one thing, Renegades is an awesome title. I think it seems so fitting in this case. But like, we all know about, like, I mean, there's so much history to the LA Guns name, and then there's so much, you know, like, people in and out, and also just like tension. And so I guess maybe speak to this lineup and how good it is to perhaps be recording without a lot of that tension.
Well, you know what, I got to tell you, the no tension mood in this band was really, really a pleasure. It was really a nice thing to have, because, like I said, we didn't have a lot of the luxuries of a huge budget or everybody being in town together, or even everybody having toured together for so many years. And it's like a brotherhood and like brothers, and you start to argue about certain things, or you start to see certain things in people, and you're living in such close quarters all over the world traveling, that, you know, obviously stuff is going to come up and tensions are going to come up. And we, in the early years from 87 to 92, we worked so much, and we would go right from one world tour into the studio to do another album and right back out. And sometimes right back out before that album was even finished. And so, you know, the no tension in this band with these four guys, Kurt, Scott, Kelly, and me, it really worked to our favor. And I got to tell you, it was just I used the word organic, because it really was. It was just a pleasure working, and there was really no past history of any beefs or anything like that. It was just a really nice feeling going in, and I think it was conveyed on the album too. It came off that way too. It came off where we were on a short schedule, but it came off so good, and I think it's a testament to being a tension-free situation too.
We often talk to bands, and especially like they talk about being hungry in the early days, and that's why some of the earlier albums are really good. And so do you think that you guys kind of have that hunger back in this case?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. You know, Kelly had stopped playing and touring for a while there, and that was his own call, and he just wanted to do that and take a break and do his own thing. He never stopped writing, though, but he stopped, you know, recording and touring. And obviously, I believe Kurt and Scotty are such great talents that never got a real good chance to show it on being in a established band that was recording all the time and touring all the time. These guys have played nonstop for years. They've been in cover bands and what have you like that, and nonstop play. And that's why their craft is so good. They're just so good at what they do. But yeah, I believe that hunger's in there too. I even had to step back after Phil left. I had to step back and reimagine the band again, because Kelly and I got together, and Kelly was so hungry to do something new and something fresh. And I believe Kurt and Scott were in the same mold. And then I was there too, because of that little bit of year and a half off of touring. And so I think there was a nice hunger feel on it within the band. And it felt like a new band with that early hunger like you have on the first couple of albums that you do. We had that in that for sure.
I mean, and another thing, of course, you've worked with some absolutely incredible lead singers. I mean, of course, Phil. You talk about Blackie Lawless and Wasp. I mean, you know, Jizzy with LA Guns, but and also like Ron Keel. I mean, we just talked to Ron. I mean, he's an amazing guy. So then, when you kind of look at lead singers, like, what was it that Kurt brought in that you kind of were like, oh, that's the guy I want?
Well, first of all, we checked him out. You know, somebody had mentioned that there's this guy, he was living in Vegas for so many years and then moved out to Florida. But a friend of mine in Vegas said, he knew that we were looking for somebody, and he said, you got to check this guy out. He has not had a chance to do something like this, and he should have a long time ago. And we did check him out on certain videos that he has on the internet, and he was tremendous. We couldn't believe it. He was really, really good. And the fact that he can sing so well, that's right up front, obviously. He's got to be able to sing really good. But he also has the attitude, and his songwriting ability is tremendous. So he had the whole package. And you know, him being a fan of LA Guns was an added bonus, too. He readily admits that he was a fan of LA Guns throughout the whole thing and really loved what we were doing. And so that was really important, too, because when we tour, you could see from the M3 show we did, we have to do a certain amount of the early material. There's no way we can play a show without doing Jane or without doing Rip and Tear or without doing Sex Action. There's a whole bunch of them, Never Enough. There's some songs there that the fans are expecting to hear. And having Kurt love that material and be able to sing it was very important too. But then him adding his own little flavor to it, and watching these videos of him, it really was like, wow, this guy, we got to fly him out and play with him for a couple days. We didn't do a big audition for singers, too. Kurt was the first guy we went into the studio with. We didn't go in and check out like 5 or 10 singers before him. He was the first guy we flew out to L.A., and when he flew back to Florida, Kelly and I, we looked at each other, and Scotty too, because Scotty's been with me for so many years. We just said, this guy is great. His attitude is great. He looks the whole part of an LA Guns member, and he just sings tremendously. So we knew right away, and we were, I got to tell you, because I've been doing it for so long, we were so very lucky too, that it was the very first guy we saw that we wanted. And it could have been a long, long process, and it wasn't. And we're like so thankful that it wasn't. But we knew right away this guy was it.
I'm just wondering, you know, considering that there's more than one version currently touring and recording as LA Guns, how do you hope to avoid confusion in the eyes of the fans as to what your version is and what you represent and stand for and what they can expect?
Well, you know what we did right off the bat, bro, was we immediately took the badge and did our own badge, because I don't have the name in the mark too. And so we wanted to make a distinction between that right away. We obviously, everybody who likes LA Guns is connected to seeing that badge. And so we wanted to take the badge, and Kelly's a great artist, too. He does all of the artwork. He did all of the artwork on the album. He put the crawl video together himself. And so he took the badge, and he worked on it, and he worked it a little bit so it was going to be different. It was going to be different than the normal LA Guns badge that I had been going out with for 30 years. And he's also making a conscientious effort when he does artwork for any of the shows or for anything to list who's in this band. It's him, me, Kurt, and Scott. And I think that we've made that very clear on anything we do, because we know there's confusion. We know that the fans might be confused, but at the very least we can do is to mention who is in this band, have a different badge, have a different backdrop, and just kind of try to differentiate ourselves from the other act, because, you know, I know it is confusing. We wish it wasn't out there and it wasn't confusing, but we got to deal with it. And that's how we're dealing with it. Kelly's putting our names pretty much on any kind of poster that's for any show to make sure the people know that it's me and Kelly Nichols with Kurt and Scotty. And so we got this black and white badge instead of the multicolored badge that we've been using. And so we're trying to help the fans know and not just confuse them any more than it is.
I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, of course, you talk about the M3 show and you talk about playing live. And I think it's such a shame that we're not able to see the shows live right now, because I mean, for you guys, I mean, it must be such an enormous financial hit, even not to be able to tour and do that kind of thing. I mean, what do you wind up doing?
Well, I tell you what, you're right about that. And it's not just us. It's everybody in this business right now. You know, everybody realizes that, and that it's been this way for a long time, that, you know, when you do a new album, you know, you expect to move some of them. And absolutely, we've got loyal fans that are going to buy albums. But we don't have any record stores anymore. We don't have that anymore, that big machinery that every band used to have around them. So a record that you do now is really a promotional item to get you out on tour. And so right now, we should have already done maybe like about 10 shows. 7 of them were festivals, and I think 3 of them were casinos. And so by now, we should have already done M3. We should have done a number of shows. And so we are feeling it. And at the same time, we just got off a Zoom call with me and Kelly and the management. And we were talking about how fortunate we were. I pushed really hard to get the album done by the end of 2019. And I'm so glad I did, because there was talk of us, maybe let's wait and maybe not rush it and do it in 2020. We would have been screwed. There would have been no way we could have done the album with this situation going on. And we would have not had any dates either to play. So we have this album that we finished at the end of 2019, and we're able to promote it and promote the band in a way that a lot of bands aren't able to do it right now. We have a finished album. We have one single out. We're going to put another single out in June, and then maybe another one in July, or maybe, because I know our dates that have been postponed, or some have been canceled, but a lot have just been postponed and pushed back. I got the new itinerary, and we start up at the beginning of August, and that's, we don't even know. We were just talking about that on our conversation, that we're hoping that happens, that it happens in August. It's wishful thinking, but, you know, I'm trying to gauge what we do off of sports. I'm a big sports nut from Boston, and I'm trying to gauge what we do. It's a very similar situation where we have a lot of people together in one area. We have a lot of tickets and a lot of concessions and a lot of merchandise booths, and we're sharing dressing rooms and the whole nine yards. It's very much like the sports situation. And I'm watching the sports thing and how are they going to start up, because it's a good gauge for what we're going to do. And, you know, I'm seeing how they're thinking about having games without fans. Well, That's not going to work for us. They can televise those sports things and they get revenue from the television and they can survive. Well, with entertainment and with rock and concerts, we need the fans and we need it to be pretty much at a normal pace because, I mean, I'm just thinking about something like an M3 or anything like that, even an outdoor show. If you try to do social distancing with 6 feet apart and blocking 6 chairs, and then there's a fan and 6 chairs are blocked, and I don't know, that sounds really crazy. So we're hoping, I've got the schedule in front of me. We start at the beginning of August in Vegas at a casino, and that's an indoor venue, and that's, again, dodgy. So we're hoping, but again, we're just thankful. We've got our album done. The artwork's done. We're doing a lot of press for it, and we have something to work on as a band right now. And we're just got our fingers crossed about the live shows. But, yeah, financially, it's a hit against everybody. Everybody's eating it right now, and everybody makes their money on the road right now. You don't make a lot of money off of recorded material. You know, you just don't anymore. And you make your money now live on the road. So this is a big hit for a lot of us, right? All of us. For anybody in entertainment, it's a huge hit.
I mean, one of the things, of course, I mean, when we talk about playing live, and you talked about the classic LA Guns. So how about some of the newer material? I mean, obviously Crawl will go into the set, but do you intend to try to put in like 4 or 5 new songs?
Yeah, you know, definitely. I don't know if we can go that many, but I could, because our sets, we don't headline, and we've never really headlined the big festivals and stuff like that. We're on the bill, and we're thankful to even be on any bills like that because so many bands would like to be. So, you know, we don't get a long set. If we got an hour set, we would still have to do 3/4 of the old material because we have so much material that fans want to hear. And there's at least 7 to 8 or 9 songs that people want to hear, and maybe we could throw in Crawl and 2 other new ones, and we would feel good about that. If we could throw in 3, maybe 4 new songs in the set and be bold and do that, then I would feel great about that. And I know Kelly would like to, and I would like to also. So that we're definitely thinking along those lines, that whatever set we do, a 45-minute set is different. Maybe we could throw in 2 new songs, and then have to do the rest of it of our older hits. But yeah, we're definitely going to throw in new material. We're definitely not going to waste any time on it. We're going to go right for it and see how it goes over live.
When it comes to things like the set or the single you choose, things like that, is it just you and Kelly who pretty much are making those decisions along with your management, or does everybody in the band kind of have a vote and have a say?
Well, you know what? I tell you what, when the 4 of us talked after we'd finished the album, we knew Crawl was a great opening single. It was a mid-tempo, really good groove song, and we thought that it had a great LA Guns flavor to it. And so the 4 of us were really leaning towards that. But we absolutely included the label, Golden Robot Records. We included them, the chief over there, Mark, and we also included our management, Eric Baker and Bobby Collin from New Breed. We asked them all to give us our opinion, what they thought, and it was pretty much consensus. Let's go with Crawl. And so absolutely, we want the input. We want that objective point of view from outside of the 4 band members. We want to know what the management and the label thinks too are strong, and their point of view on what we do too is very important to us. We think it's a great objective outlook on, instead of the band saying, oh, we love this song. We had already been leaning towards Crawl, but I don't think they even knew it, because they came back on their own and said, wow, let's come out of the gate with Crawl. And it was just great that we were all on the same page.
One of the things that Kelly talked about, I mean, was the energy, like how much he loves energy in songs. And so, like, he would talk about Magdalene being one of his favorite or the original songs, and just and just how much energy these songs have on the new album. So I'm wondering, like, what are your favorite of the original LA Guns, like the classic LA Guns songs?
I really like, when we do Ballad of Jane, I love it. I know it's a ballad, and I know that it's a down-tempo song, but I love seeing the reaction of people when we play Jane. I really dig playing Jane live. I think it's a great feeling within the whole arena or the shed or wherever we might be playing. And obviously, I love playing Sex Action and Never Enough. I think they're great songs, great rock songs. I think they were put together really, really well. And, you know, those are some of my favorites. But then I have my favorites like Kelly does off of the deep cuts off of the album, like Magdalene and Malaria. I love those songs. And I love the fact that we were ballsy enough to step out and do something like that. And I don't believe other bands were stepping out like that and doing something like a Magdalene or a Malaria or something like that. And, you know, it was a very ballsy move on our part to do that. We knew they weren't going to be singles, but we knew that they were going to be nice album cuts. And those are some of my favorites, too. I love doing those guys.
I'm interested in drumming style. I mean, obviously, like I said, we're really big fans of yours. I mean, the LA Gun stuff, but I mean, Wasp, we absolutely love Wasp. And so, like, is there a difference in style, maybe, that you would bring to each of the different bands? And, of course, I know you did lots of session work as well.
Right, yeah, you know, it's funny because Wasp and LA Guns were very similar to when I got in them. I was doing the Right to Rock with Keel while Wasp was recording their first album. And I was finishing up the Right to Rock, the background vocals with Gene Simmons and working with him at the old record plant. And we were right near the end of finishing the Right to Rock when Blackie called me out of the blue. I didn't know him. I knew about Wasp, but I didn't know Blackie. And he asked me to come over and check out the situation. And I went over there, and like I said, we weren't even finished with the Right to Rock. We hadn't even finished the, I believe we were in mix, and we had finished the background vocals, and I did all of those backgrounds with Gene. Gene and I did all the background vocals on the Right to Rock. But anyways, I went over and I checked out the Wasp stuff, and Wasp and LA Guns were very, very similar. They both had recorded their first albums with drummers that they had been playing the clubs with, and they both let their drummers go before their albums were released. So I stepped into two similar situations, and both albums I love. I love the first Wasp album. I love Tony Richards drumming on that first album, and I got to know him, and he's a great guy, but I love his drumming on that, and I love the first LA Guns album. I was doing the Right to Rock when when Wasp was doing their first album, and then I was doing Live in the Raw with Wasp when LA Guns was doing their first album. So I was working right up to the point of joining those two bands, and I do believe I brought a different flavor to both bands, and I'm proud that both first albums that I recorded with both bands had some really big hits on them too. I think that The Last Command with Wild Child and Blind in Texas, I'm so glad I played the drums on those. I feel proud of that, and I think that I brought my own style to Wasp, and I brought it to another level. And I also think that when I did Cocked and Loaded with LA Guns, and we were able to pull off Jane and Never Enough and Rip and Tear, I'm so happy that I got to record those songs with them too. And again, I thought that I brought a different style to both bands. And I hope that I brought it up a notch in both bands too, because, you know, I'm proud of what I do. I worked hard on my craft and I played on a lot of stuff from 75 on. And I just felt like I brought a new flavor to both bands. And those both first albums I did with Wasp and LA Guns, The Last Command and Cocked and Loaded, happened to be two of the biggest albums that each band did, too. And I'm glad that I got to play on them and bring my style to both bands.
You know, as we talk Wasp, we can't not mention Chris Holmes because he's one of the most unique human beings in the history of music, I think it's fair to say. He's legendary in many ways, including on this podcast. We've been lucky enough to get a whole bunch of great stories from people interacting with him. Do you have any Chris Holmes stories you could share with us?
Yeah, you know, I did 4 years with them, and Chris and I were very tight. We were really cool together, and we hung out a lot. And he's like one of a kind, for sure. I played with hundreds of musicians, and Chris stands out as a one-of-a-kind person. And I'm so happy that I got to play with Chris. I think he's just a wonderful talent and a great guitar player. But his personality was just F you to everybody, and a chuckle laugh after that too. And I just thought that he was one of the most ballsiest guys. I went around the world with him so many times, and he was just one of a kind. And there's so many stories with Chris Holmes, you know. I mean, I don't know, you know, we did that first tour where we went over to Europe, and it's documented on the live at the Lyceum when we did all the meet and all of that stuff with the girl on the rack. And you know, we went to Europe doing that too. And we used to throw the meat out in the middle of the show. You know, we had the whole situation where Blackie would throw the meat out. And you know, one evening he was throwing the meat out, and we're doing that drone behind him, that beat behind him, so he had quite a long time. It was like about a 15-minute situation where he was doing the meat, and we were just droning behind him with a beat and a little bit of a musical thing, instrumental thing. And one night he was throwing the meat out, and there was a lot of smoke and fog, you know. And I'm up on my riser and doing this thing with the meat, and I'm watching Blackie do it, and Chris is to my left, and you know, out of nowhere, out of the smoke from the crowd, you know, I see something tumbling over and over, and it's coming towards the stage, and it's pretty huge. And somebody had thrown up on the stage like a frozen leg of lamb or something. It was a frozen piece of meat, and it hit him right in the head, Chris, right in the head. And it knocked him out. He went right down on the stage, and it was serious but funny as shit. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe this thing came out of the audience, and it was frozen, and it tagged him right on the head, and he went down, and we kept playing, Randy Piper and myself, and it was just a funny situation. But that kind of thing, you know, not that extreme, but that kind of thing with Chris was a common thing. And if you weren't close to him, you'd probably think he was a dangerous guy to be around, but he was really a really cool guy to be around. And I just have a great friendship with him, and I'm glad I did, man. I think he's a great talent too.
One of the things that we did was when we asked Kelly, of course, because we knew that we were talking to you this week. So we asked Kelly for some dirt on you, and he told us that he used to stick panties into your kit and into your clothes and stuff so that you would go home to your wife.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I'm telling you, man, it was great. You know, that's the really cool thing about bands too, is that we become so close on the road too. Yeah, we pull pranks on each other, and we're hanging so much together. We're like living right on top of each other, whether it's on a tour bus or in a hotel or in the dressing room. It's the four or five of us always together. And, you know, obviously we got to like divert it from just playing and touring, and we have to have some fun with it too. And stuff like Kelly described, yeah, that shit was so funny, man. It was like crazy stuff. We were always pulling pranks on each other, and it was kind of good too. It was healthy for the band too to have some fun like that too. So yeah, that's why with Chris Holmes, I can't even, there were so many stories that I can't even think of them. That's how crazy it is. It's like I can only think of a couple, but I know there's probably 100 of them.
I don't suppose the first time you did that, though, it would be very funny to your wife.
I know. No, and you know what I'm saying? And that's the other thing, too, you know, it's like, you know, everything that we're doing, too, because, you know, especially in the early days, too, when it was all the chicks in the audience were dressed in underwear. They came in panties and bras, pretty much. And, you know, they're draped all over the band, too. So you got to play it safe, too. And it's like, you know you have a significant other or a girlfriend or wife or whatever. And, you know, it's kind of like a little bit of a tightrope you have to walk and be careful, too. And, yeah, you know, you stuff like that, you got to, there's got to be an explanation. You got to come up with some reason why it happened.
I know Kelly told us that, you know, it was the road crew would get it. He didn't participate, he said. He said it was all the road crew getting all the underwear.
Yeah, and our road crew, too, because they become so close with us and we all had our own tech, not like we're doing now, where it's a little stripped down and we have like maybe two techs come out with us and they cover on a bunch of different bases. We all had our own tech. I had my drum tech and there was three guitar techs and the guy who took care of Phil and then the road manager. So, you know, they became brothers with us too. And we all bonded so tight. I'm sure it was like that with every band, but, yeah, you bond so tight with the road crew and the band, and especially when you're all traveling on one bus before you start to make a little bit of extra money and you can afford a couple of buses and there's a crew bus and a band bus and there's a little separation. When there's one bus and the crew and band are on there together, you get so tight, man. It's like a big brotherhood of just all friends, and then boom, the door opens and we're off and working and everybody gets into their place. But back on that bus, it's crazy, man. It was crazy. And it was really cool too. It was a nice little brotherhood thing going on.
I mean, we're like Mo and I, huge fans of the Sunset Strip era. So I'm just wondering maybe if you have any like recollections from that period that you think would be fun to share.
In what period was that? I'm sorry.
Oh, the Sunset Strip era. You know, in the 80s and that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, again, I when I moved out to Los Angeles, I came out like in 1977, and I was with a bunch of people hanging at the Rainbow from 77 until Quiet Riot broke in 82. And we were all trying to get our things off the ground or get with a band to make some noise and see, to do a showcase, everybody. But there was a period in LA at the Rainbow between 77 and 82 where there was a lot of us hanging around waiting to see what was going to happen. And I mean, that was like Stephen Pearcy, Frankie Benelli, Randy Castile, Nikki Sixx, Blackie Lawless, all of us, Kevin DeBrow, we were all hanging out at the Rainbow waiting to see what we were going to do, what somebody else was going to be doing, people playing at the Starwood and the Troubadour, but not having a record deal yet. And that was a really, really fun time. It was because after 82 and Quiet Riot broke, everybody got record deals and everybody was on their way, especially that crowd of people. And everybody I mentioned, we weren't hanging together. We were just all at the Rainbow. And like, we kind of knew each other, kind of. You know, I knew Randy Castile really well before that. But it was a great time. There was a bunch of people that became really well known and we weren't at the time. And we were hanging in the same place and just waiting for our turn, and then everybody got their turn, and it was I think it's something everybody misses too. It was a real innocent time too, where nobody was really connected to anything, and we were just really like loose, free spirits. And you know, obviously the Strip went off after that too. You know, from 81 on, the Strip to 81 to 92 was crazy. It was packed with different bands and shit. And that period of us all hanging at the Rainbow, seeing each other, kind of knowing each other and not really having record deals yet. And then seeing after 82, all of us signing record deals and being in different bands and then running into each other. I think it was a pretty cool deal, man. It was a really cool scene at the Rainbow between 77 and 82.
That's fantastic. Now, another thing I know that you've handled the business end of bands for a long time, you know, for LA Guns. So, you know, how difficult is that?
You know what? It is difficult in a way because nobody wants to do it. I mean, I was coming into LA Guns as the most seasoned guy. I was coming out of Wasp with Iron Maiden's management and that big machinery around Iron Maiden. That same machine was around Wasp. We got the same machine. That's why Wasp and Maiden toured together so many years for a long time. When I was in the band, we did so many tours with Maiden. And so I'm coming from this big machine into this club, virtually pretty much a club band. LA Guns hadn't done anything outside of LA. They've only done a few club shows here in Los Angeles. So they had built a machine around them of guys that were really well-intentioned, but they weren't going to be able to take the band to the next level. And when I joined, I knew that. The guys were all great guys. The management they had, the accountant, the agent, everybody, they were very nice guys and everything and cool people. But to take the band to the next level, I told the band, we got to do something. We have to build a machine around this band that's going to be able to work us and get us on the tours and get us on radio and really work the band the right way. And so when I joined LA Guns, I was kind of nominated right away to be the president CEO of LA Guns, Al Snug. And they all wanted me to take it over. And so, I'm talking about the whole band. And so what I did was I went out right away by myself and I interviewed managers and I already knew the accountant and agency we should go with. It was the people that were made in Wasp. But the management was a very, very important decision. And I went out and I interviewed like a 12 really big managers too. And I settled on Alan Kovac, and now he's huge. He's been managing Motley for years. But at that time, he had only had Richard Marx. And so the reason why I thought we should go with Alan Kovac was because he could take us to radio. He had already taken Richard Marx to radio, and Richard Marx is nothing like LA Guns, but we needed somebody that could work radio. And so I nominated Alan Kovac as the guy, and the guys went along with me. And obviously from that point of me joining the band to now, I had to run the business. I had to be the liaison between the band and the management and the band and the agency, what have you. And it's sometimes you got to separate yourself too. And that's the drag of it. Sometimes you have to tell the band, we've got to do this. And you know, it's going to sometimes not be agreed on and you want to be on the band side, but you also know that what you're saying is the right thing we got to do. So you got to separate yourself. And that's the only part that sucks about it. And you know, I know that I can do it, and I've continued to do it for 30, 35 years, be the business guy of the band. But that's the one drag part of it, is that sometimes you got to separate yourself and tell the band, this is what we got to do. And you don't want to be an authoritarian figure. You're just saying, this is what we have to do. This is the right move. And so there's a little separation there, and that's the one drag part of it, but you know you're making the right call. And I think I made the right call with building the machine around us, because we got right on the radio with Cocked and Loaded. Boom, we were up there with Never Enough and Ballad of Jane, and Alan Kovac did a tremendous job with the band, and everything worked out good. And with the agency, that we got on a ton of tours. And so, you know, I'm still doing the business. I'm still doing it now, and it's because I know I can do it, and I know that it might be a little bit cumbersome for another band member to do it, and they might not have all the angles to look at like I could. And so, you know, I don't mind doing it. It's not something I really wanted to do, but I knew that somebody had to do it, and I continue to do it nowadays. But like I said, the one drag down point of it is you definitely have to separate yourself from the band sometimes and say, we have to do something. And it's like, you know, all of a sudden you're talking like a manager instead of the drummer in the band, but something that has to be done.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, of course, especially in this day and age when not everybody, I mean, you can't afford, like you were talking about all the techs that you were able to bring along. Now, well, now, I mean, you can't afford to have somebody doing every little piece of the business. So, I mean, it's great that you have that knowledge to be able to kind of do it yourself.
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad that I know how to do it, and I know how to make moves and how to make the band stay active and get into a studio or get on a tour or put a tour together or what have you. Even the schedule we just did to record Renegades, it was something that I sat down by myself and said, okay, this is when I can get them in. I got to find the right rehearsal studio. I got to find the right recording studio. And we had just done four albums with Andy Johns, Phil and I. And I got really close with Andy Johns. I was really fortunate to work with a lot of great producers in my career, a ton of great producers. And Andy Johns is, he's just up there with the best of them. And I used that machine that Andy and I had put together to do those four albums with LA Guns, and he had passed away, so I could, you know, I had to do it on my own, and I used that machinery. But yeah, I'm doing it now, and I know that we don't have a lot of elbow room. We don't have that big budget, so you got to think quick and think about how you can do this on a tight budget and a tight schedule. And yeah, I'm continually doing it right now, you know, and trying to figure out what could be the next good move for the band.
Yeah, well, Steve, we thank you so very much. I know we're running close to the end of our time with you. We've appreciated all of it, so we want to give you the opportunity right now to tell all the fans where they can find LA Guns and Renegades, of course, when it comes out.
Well, you know what? Kelly Nichols runs our Facebook page. It's the LA Guns official Facebook page, and he runs laguns.net. And anything that you want to know about the band, about what we're doing, the new Renegades album that's going to be coming out on Golden Robots, everything that we're doing is up on laguns.net and our official LA Guns Facebook page. And, you know, there's all kinds of merchandise out there that Kelly's designed, and just about anything you'd want to know. So, like, I want the fans to know that, and to know that we got another single coming out next month, too. We're talking about which song it would be, because the album has so much depth. But, yeah, check out our website and our Facebook page, and you'll be surprised. Kelly's got some great stuff up there.
He's a very talented artist, absolutely. So,
Oh, yeah.
Well, Steve, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Like I say, I mean, we are big fans of LA Guns, big fans of your work. So we wish you nothing but the best in the future. And I do hope that Renegades is everything and more that you hope for.
I thank you guys, too, big time for the support. And thanks for having me on your show. And I hope to see you guys out on the road soon. And be safe, okay?
Sounds good. You too. And yes, absolutely. We want to see LA Guns. We want to see LA Guns in concert, not 6 feet apart from everybody.
Right on.
I'm
looking forward to seeing you guys. Yeah. Keep your fingers crossed right now, because we're hoping that this thing clears up. But in the meantime, yeah, I hope you two guys and your families be safe. Okay.
And same to you. All the best.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Right.
I'll talk
Thanks,
to you
Steve.
Later.
Okay. Bye now.
Okay. Bye bye.
Chocolate and I'm hypnotized. You got it all wrapped up like sugar and spice. like the high command. Just a cat in a rock and roll band. Icy cold with the jet black sand.